session number 25054, Real 9.
Derek Plummer, Real 9. So we'll just backtrack a little bit. If we go back to the convoy JW57, okay, so you've told us in some detail about your story about what happened.
Yes.
And what happened to your captain.
Yes.
So you referred to a book which was written by Campbell.
By Ian Campbell.
Who was, just remind us?
He was Captain D, senior officer of the escort of that convoy in Milne.
Right, and you disagree with the account that he's given in the book?
Oh, absolutely. Shall I read that now?
Would you do that? You
yes.
Just a short
yes.
extract you can do.
Yes, it's 211.
While that story is still fresh in our mind.
Now, this is a man that I served with when he was Commander-in-Chief South Atlantic and West Indies, when I was in Sierra Leone in peacetime. It was in 1953, 4, 5, or 4, 5, 6. He came up quite a lot to Freetown. I was the only, one of two officers up there, so we got to know each other quite well. And then he wrote this book. Unfortunately, it's called The Kola Run. Kola Rendlet is the place we were talking about. And I see in the book that it wasn't written, first published in 1958. So I had left Sierra Leone, and he had left Sierra Leone and retired about 2 years before. So when I knew him, I didn't know he was going to write this book. In fact, I didn't even know he was Captain D of that particular convoy. I had never met him, and I'd heard about him. He was always known as Jock Campbell, a little man, very Scotch, little tiny man. I should have thought a very, very easy man to get on with, provided everything went the way he wanted to go. He could be a little difficult at times, and then everybody is. Now, this is it. Improved radar in the escorts also gave greater confidence in their ability to keep their flock together in thick and tempestuous weather. The convoys would be increased in size, therefore. JW57, which left Loch Ewe, we didn't join it until Loch Ewe is down on the northwest coast of Scotland, and we picked them up when they got up by Cape Roth and then up to Iceland. The convoys would be increased in three sides. Loch Ewe, on the 20th of February, the convoy was 42 strong, and the auxiliary carrier Chaser joined the escort. In addition to the through and ocean escorts, a support group, there was the people wandering around in front, from the western approaches, was to accompany it as far as Bear Island. In command of this sizable fleet, which was thus assembled when the ocean convoy joined the convoy from the Faroes, was Vice Admiral Glennie, who had relieved that adjutant. And the carrier commander, the group commander, was Captain Campbell himself. In Milne, HMS Milne, he controlled the convoy screen. As has been demonstrated in the Atlantic, this combination of close escort, support group, and air escort was too much altogether for the submarines. Their effects were completely disorganized, and not once did they penetrate this particular convoy, whilst an escorting Catalina caught and sank one of them, and Chaser's Swordfish, that was the carrier, Chaser's Swordfish, harried them, made repeated attacks on the U-boat. But once again, thwarted in their main objective, the enemy turned his weapon onto the escort. In the black of night, which it wasn't, with a heavy swell running and frequent blinding snow flurries, a U-boat brought off what was, to give the devil his due, a brilliantly skillful attack in putting two torpedoes into the destroyer Maratta. This calamity was made doubly tragic by the fearful loss of life that resulted. So far, so good. She did get a second torpedo, but that was not a gnat. It went into the ship's side. We didn't know that at the time. We were only told later. We didn't get her signal. The impulsive, it should be just impulsive, we never use the impulsive, had quickly come to the Maratta's aid and found her still afflict. Yes. In touch by radio telephone, we hadn't got one, and manoeuvring round as guided by Lieutenant Commander Drought, the Maratta's captain, we never had that at all. He instructed Impulsive to come bow to stern alongside her forecastle. This is absolute nonsense. if he did instruct us to go bow to stern, why didn't we do it? We were still at right angles to her as she sank. We had
you would have known if that signal had been received.
Oh, definitely, definitely. It would come straight to the bridge. I don't know how it would have come. And no signal was made. We made two signals, and there were those ridiculous signals I told. And we had no radio telephone, so we couldn't have done that. The impulsive equipment of the Lieutenant Commander. Lieutenant Commander Bakken, that's Pinky, spelt incorrectly here, of impulsive, could see lights from the damaged ship gleaming through the falling snow. No snow, no lights gleaming through anything. Suddenly the lights vanished, and Maratta rolled steeply over, she didn't, to port and capsized. She went straight down by the stern. By the time impulsive reached the spot, only struggling figures, saturated and blinded by oil fuel, rapidly becoming paralyzed by the cold, was to be seen. As impulsive drifted down on them, yes, we did, scramble nets over the side, few had the strength left to grasp them, fewer still were able to hoist themselves up the stiffly frozen rope nets. Volunteers from impulsive's crew at the bottom of the nets, repeatedly doused by the icy water, as the ship rolled, did what they could to help them. But alas, the total number saved was 17 out of a company of just over 200. That's the story. Now, if that was true, then Bakken had done exactly what he was instructed to do, A, by the admiral, or Milne, and B, he did what the captain of Maratta told us to do, come down, but whilst presumably while we were doing that, she sank. She didn't sink until all her men had all drowned as she went down. They had been in the water at least a minute, 2 or 3 minutes probably. The point is that if that story is correct, mine is not correct. If that had happened, probably the captain would have been decorated or got something, Bakken. He would have been praised for the work. Instead of that, he was sacked by an admiral who heard our story, who believed our story, and that was far from it. Actually, one version I've seen in one other ship said there were two destroyers sent to help, and passive from one other. That is not true. We were the only ones there. He doesn't mention the other one. But all this about being instructed to come bow to stern down the side, as instructed by their captain, Lieutenant Commander Drought, his name, D-R-O-U-G-H-T, is nonsense. And all this signal telephone things, nonsense, we had no such thing. It's all wrong. The story is absolutely true, as I told you. The only thing I don't know, and I still don't know, is the actual timing of it all. I don't know what time it all happened. I am assuming I had the afternoon watch. If you had the navigational manual on a lot of aid, you could work out, go back and find out what time it got dark, because it was just getting dark when we decided to pack up and go, and all the little figures down there in the water were showing up clearly with the little red lights. And that is it. That was Milne.
What was the atmosphere like on board Impulsive?
Stunned, absolutely stunned to silence. Everybody. It couldn't believe it. One captain there has written a book, and he said that he was there on that convoy, and he said that it was the shock of it was as horrible as the sinking of the Hood. It was unbelievable. And one other thing he mentioned, he said this was one of the most extraordinary, dreadful things that ever happened. He didn't come with us. He was one of the convoy destroyers that stayed. Only one came, and that was Impulsive. So that was it. But going back to, if I may, just to Charles Shelley Battersby and his little saying, do you want to hear about D-Day? It wasn't terribly important.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes. We'll do it all if you don't mind.
Yes. So can we? Yeah, should we go back
we
to?
Just finish with the Maratta. So you took 17 on board, and some of those died, did they?
I think we only landed alive 9. I think it was that.
Yeah.
So
what facilities did you have on board for them? Where did you put them?
Oh, in the mess decks. In the mess, yes. Yeah. They would have gone straight into sick bay first of all. The doctor would make sure, and get
remember that. Your doctor? Who was your doctor?
Thompson. He was a big Irishman. Tall. Yeah. I've got a photograph of that. Time. Yeah. He would have been looking after them. And providing they had survived, that's a silly thing, as they had survived, it wouldn't have taken very long for them to get back to normal, only a few minutes or so warm. And they would have been, they were messed in with a mess. And if there was any trouble physically, then they would have gone into sickbay. I think we had four births in sickbay, a little sickbay there.
And those that died were died of the cold,
presumably. Yes, yes,
they
yes.
Didn't
yeah,
recover,
yeah.
As it were.
It was a common thing, common practice.
Yeah. And so you conducted a burial?
We carried out a lot of burials. Always the same. You tie them in a bag with an empty shell case. It's heavy.
So when you say a bag, what sort of bag?
You canvas. Make a bag around them and put a heavy shell case with them so it sinks. Tie it all up, Union Jack, Union flag round. Board, drop the guardrails on the quarterdeck. A very brief service, which was a sort of standard practice thing. Everyone knew what to say. A few ratings, and the first lieutenant will probably conduct the service. We didn't have a padre on board a destroyer, and then tip them over and away they go. Well, I must tell you completely, during the war, we were at Scarpa, and we were duty destroyer. One destroyer was always duty, and it was Impulsive's turn, and we were asked by, told by the commander-in-chief that we were taking a body to sea out of Scarpa, bury it on the Pentland Firth and go back. And it was a commander XYZ, let's say Smith, it certainly wasn't, who had a twin brother. And the twin brother was in Admiralty. I'll get his name, it began with B, but it doesn't matter. Other brother was up in Scarpa, and he was demonstrating on the island of Flotta, was where all the heavy big ships, battleships, because sent their men for recreation and things like that. And he built a dirty great pile of inflammable, or now known as inflammable in those days, material. And he was shouting to several hundred people about firefighting on board a ship. And someone inadvertently set fire to the pile, and this bloke was cremated. The commander, he was the gunnery officer in the flagship. I wish I could remember his name. So they couldn't do anything about it. He just was burnt to death. And we were the ship carrying out the funeral. We couldn't put a battleship to sea for a burial. A destroyer was so easy. And before the funeral actually took place, whilst we were still in Scarpa, we filled up with the brother who came up from Admiralty and his wife, the victim's wife, quite a lot of senior officers, including Commander-in-Chief, who came aboard for the funeral. And we went out into, I was navigator, thank God. Number one had to cope with the social side of it down there, a tiny little wardroom with all these guests for the funeral. And he went through the service, and a padre this time, Fleet Padre, came on, and the body went in, and it didn't sink. And so we were on the bridge, the captain and I, we could see this it's happening. It was Pinky Buchan in his time. And I said, you know, it's not going to sink. So he said, go down, pilot, tell number one to get everybody off the quarterdeck, down into the wardroom and get some drinks inside them. So we did that. I said to Slavek, down there, and tons of he's leaving, and they all went down. I rushed back to the bridge. We manned the pom-pom gun, and we blazed away at this coffin until we hit it several times. The pom-pom's like a boom, 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 a huge shell it fires. Wonderful gun, for anti-aircraft work, pom-poms. And eventually we sank it, and he said, go down to the washroom and tell them there's been a German aircraft, and we frightened it off, it didn't attack us. And I went down and I told them the story. I said, I told the Admiral, and I said, I'm very sorry about this, but there's been an aircraft and we had to fire at it. And I said, would you like to tell all the visitors? He said, certainly. And he turned, he said, is that true? I said, no. Bloody thing wouldn't sink. He said, thank you. And that was it. We went straight back. But that's what can happen if you don't put a proper weight in to sink it.
So he was buried at sea because he wanted to be, do you think?
Yes, I think so, yes. I don't know how much there was left of him being burnt. It was pretty. No. So that was that. But that was long before all this happened.
Okay, and just a few more questions.
Yes.
Did you ever go to the submarine school at Gladstone Dock in Liverpool?
No.
You were talking about the different zigzag patterns that you undertook.
Yes.
Can you tell me about those?
Well, there was a book, which of course was secret. It was kept in that little locker underneath the signalman's caboose in the sort of top, the front right-hand starboard side of the bridge. And when the when Zigzag was going to be introduced into the force or whatever it was, the senior officer would make a signal saying, at a certain time, Zigzag pattern number so-and-so, to get the book and see what the zig... And there it was, drawn up, and it would be a turn to port 70 degrees, and then possibly a further turn to port 5 minutes later. So it would tell you all the moves in the number of degrees and which direction you're turning and for how long you do it. 5 minutes, then 15 degrees to starboard for 6.5 minutes. It was, and they got more and more complicated. And it wasn't just that. Of course, even a German and a U-boat can see what's going to happen if you're doing that. So you do this and do it, and then suddenly the other way. It was to put the U-boats off. They never quite knew what course you were on.
So would all the destroyers in the convoy do the same
thing? Work together, and the convoy as well.
Oh, right.
If it was good enough weather, they would do it. But usually it was pretty lousy, and you didn't zigzag at all. And, of course, if there's visibility closes down, you just stop it straight away. But we did zigzag with the monsters. I don't know what we were there for, because if one of those had sunk with, let's say, 15,000 men on board, I suppose a destroyer might be able to cope in those seas no more than 100 extra, and that would be making it fairly top-heavy. 200 should turn over. So 15,000. And we weren't even working as decks because of the speed we were going and the heavy seas. We broke her back, and she was eventually, after about 3 months after D-Day, she was taken in hand and scrapped. I was in another ship by then.
Getting back towards D-Day, do you know what was in the documents that were dropped?
Yes, it was all our instructions. Yes, and the exact position we had to go to. It showed us all the movements of ships, the channels we were to use, the navigational information, and there was a very, very good chart, which was a top secret chart, which we couldn't use for navigation, but showed us all the German guns and their arcs of fire and range. So you knew when you were at that particular spot which guns could actually reach you and where they would be firing from, if they were going to fire at us at all.
So it was meticulously
prepared. Yes, to the minutest detail. Mm. They're wonderful. I mean, they've been working at it for 2 years. Mm. But the number of ships there, it was unbelievable. You never, never see the like again. And I can't remember any collisions. Several ships ran aground. There was that one on television last night before, that did you see that?
No,
they're trying to find out, because a frigate, and I never even knew it was that name, I can't remember what it was, 2 nights ago, she ran aground on Sword Beach on D-Day, 2 days after D-Day, and the Admiralty said she was struck by a bomb delivered by an aircraft, a German aircraft, and everyone has disbelieved that for years, because we had complete air superiority over the beaches. No German aircraft came, and no one ever saw the aircraft. And they've examined it, and they've decided what happened. It was delivered by an aircraft, but it was the doodlebug. You remember the doodlebug? It was a controllable doodlebug fired miles away by an aircraft who could alter it and bring it down on. But why they chose a little frigate when there were battleships and cruisers and everything, God knows. So that was it.
So tell me about, you had Boy Browning on board, and the other general was...
General Sir Miles Dempsey. Yes.
Right. So how far ahead of time did you know when D-Day would be? I mean, you knew something was going to happen.
The actual timing, I suppose, was 24 hours ahead.
Right.
And then only a limited number of people.
Mm. And that would just be the senior officers?
Well, I mean, I think commanding officers of all ships would know 24 hours.
Right.
You would tell the time when you could open the instructions. Those are the ones that we lost and had to go back for a second helping. we knew then, but you didn't tell anyone. I mean, it was obviously a limited number of people who knew that. Mm. And then we all set sail together.
So you just carried these generals?
Yes, three officers, the General Dempsey, Boy Browning, and Dempsey's ADC, a full colonel.
Right. And where did you land?
We were almost the furthest to the east on Sword. Sword was the nearest one to Le Havre. and the order went to Sword, whatever the next was, Juno, and then other three, that was Britain and Canada, and then all the rest were the Americans. And the Americans went right almost to Sherbrooke. We were there, and we were right opposite a little town called Wistrom, which is now a very flourishing tourist place. Then we watched the tanks and that, and the soldiers fighting. It was rather like that episode in Sicily when I watched the fighting from the beaches. Here we had a very good view. We took on board before we sailed a captain in the army.
Before
we left to land the troops. There was two or three days before D-Day, we got an army officer on board, and he was a BLO, and that stood for Bombardment Liaison Officer. Sounds marvellous. All it was that he was going to interpret army jargon for us, and ashore, a gun battery is firing at the Germans, and somewhere between the gun battery and the Germans is a man who's watching the fall of shot for the English. He is in touch with this man here, and he has called for fire, for us to start firing at a particular target, and he would be watching, and he would report to BLO here. After the first fall of shot, he'd say, up 500, so we increased the range of our gun, the shell, by 500 yards, and left 15, and we're way over, so we turn our guns 15 degrees. And by doing this from time to time, we could get onto whatever we were firing at. We never knew what we were firing at. I couldn't see. We just... And the BLO, the blow, was in contact with the... I don't know what they call them, the officer at the other end. But between them, they controlled our guns, really.
So when these two generals came on board, did you speak to them?
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
What were they like?
Very nice indeed.
Were they very keyed up? Because this was the big...
Well, Dempsey was an extremely quiet man. Boy Browning never stopped talking, and you couldn't get a word in. And on the way over... in the morning, early morning, because all the gliders were going over much earlier, and we were out there. And every towed aircraft, they were towing all the gliders behind. And whoever was near Boy Browning got a huge hit on the back. Said, "They're all mine, those are mine, those are mine." It was like a child jumping around, because he was never meant to be there. I don't know what would happen. No. He did say he was. And how Dempsey accepted him, I don't know. He was very serious minded, but very serious.
Browning was just hitching a lift, wasn't he?
Just to go over for the fun of it.
Right.
Yeah. He said he was going. I asked him, I said, "Are you coming back with us?" And he said, no, I'm not. He said, anyway, he said, "You're not going back today, are you?" He said, "No, not for two or three days." He said, "Well, no, I shall go ashore and see what happens."
Yeah. And what about Dempsey? What was his role?
His role was in charge of the First Army, the First Army Commander.
Yeah.
That was his. You see, Montgomery was an overall charge of the military operation, and his senior officer in charge of the First Army was Dempsey, who did very well, I gather.
Yeah. So what did Dempsey say to you? Did you gather anything from him as to what was going to happen?
Or no, nothing. No. Very little information.
Right. So he kept his personal. Yes. How long did you have them on board?
Well, the night before. They joined about supper time the night before, whatever the date was. I gave Browning my cabin, and at some ghastly hour in the morning, sort of, "Oh God, W," we were underway, and they didn't sleep all that time. They just really used it as a restroom, I think, and somewhere to put their gear.
But what sort of time was it when you got across?
We were there before 6.
What could you see as you came in up the French coast, and what action was going on and so on?
Well, I don't know what time the action started. Of course, the first action was had started 6 or 7 hours before. That was there's a wonderful book called Pegasus Bridge. It was they were all the airborne blokes as well.
So what did you see as
we get in, there's a massive, very low coastline, beaches, you know, all sand for miles, but it was fairly dark. And we could see, we were certainly not the first ashore there. We went through landing craft waiting to go in. And we went in, you could see masses of ships still, masses of landing craft, troops running all over the beaches, quite a lot of firing going on, because the Germans were still there. And that lasted for some hours. I mean, it was like being in a movie. We could see the tanks firing at each other and so on. But and it didn't mean much. It looked more like toys at that distance.
Yeah. And your two generals, they...
We took them ashore and landed them.
In a motorboat,
yes. And it was very rough.
Do you take them?
I'm ashamed to say I did. What happened was it was very rough, and we hadn't got a landing craft. We couldn't put a motorboat, if you run onto a beach like that, is going to turn because she's that shape. She's either going to turn that way, and she'll capsize. So you have to be very cautious, and with luck, if you've got, if it's rough enough, you drop a sea anchor or an anchor about 100 yards from you, and you ease yourself in on that. As the wind is trying to take you ashore, you just let yourself go slowly towards the beach. As soon as you touch the beach, no further, hold on to it. So the anchor's now holding you, and you just pray to God you're not going to be thrown around. And this is what happened. And I said to the captain, you know, this is going to be a hell of a job to get these two generals and the colonel ashore. They're going to get very wet indeed. And I said, someone really ought to go with the motorboat, an officer. And he said, yes, quite. Tell number one. And I said to number one, you know, if I can get the captain's approval, can I go in with the motorboat? He said, yeah, sure. So the captain approved, said, yes. He said, don't be bloody long, will you? He said, you will come back. I said, well, if it capsizes the boat, we shall be long. But we didn't. And I went in with the motorboat, and it was far too rough, really, like that. And it soon quieted down. And I jumped over, got very wet indeed, very wet, to help the three army officers down. They got pretty wet too, but not, I mean, all their trousers, they walked into water that high, and there was a lot of spray breaking waves and that. It was very uncomfortable for them. And they just said, thank you very much, and went up the beach. And then we had the awful job of trying to get the boat back to the, which actually turned out very well indeed.
Was there any stuff landing near you in the water? I mean, was there stuff landing on the beach? And
the shells? Or
yes.
From the Germans?
Yeah.
Yes, but not at us. It was the people being shot at as they got out of the landing craft.
They were concentrating on that, weren't they?
Yes, and of course, very, very soon, there were so many, they were pushing the Germans back rapidly. And after that, it was all inland, really. We didn't see very much. One of the problems was that an operation like that, or anywhere, you want something to take bearings off to see where you are. And the most obvious things everywhere were the churches. You could see the churches in Caen, which was over the horizon, not this side of the horizon. And then there was a church, Wieskrum, and the next place. And all the churches looked roughly alike. So being a brilliant artist, I got my chart, and I drew all the churches on the top of the chart and circled them and put an arrow right down to where it was on the chart. So that anybody up there, the rest of them, could say, you know, where are we? That is that church. Take a bearing. Which is that church? Oh, it's that one there. That's the bearing. And then find another church. And it was gave us a reference point to get a fix on it. So, and all we did there was to shell occasionally for the first couple of days. After that, we didn't fire another gun, I don't think. And we did submarine patrols in case the U-boats came in, which they didn't. But we were doing a box search one night with another I-class destroyer.
Is this going in amongst the fleet?
right behind them, out at sea. So we were covering the approach, really. And we were doing a box search at night, and we didn't realise that the other ship was with us. I mean, we do this, like, you don't pass each other because you're miles apart, you're just searching. We found that she wasn't with us, and she had been attacked from Le Havre. They'd come out with motor torpedo boats, and they'd sunk her. And we didn't hear it or anything. That was the last but one of the I-class destroyers, in part, and it was Icarus. No, Isis was sunk.
So, did you think that D-Day was going to be successful? We were actually going to.
Oh yes.
Why was that?
Because it had been so thoroughly researched. I mean, everything was so well done, and we had an enormous force. The Americans produce a lot of men and things like that. And actually, it went rather worse. And Caen proved a major problem. It was very difficult. Once Caen was cleared by Montgomery's men, then it was easy. They just swept through France. But I had no doubt at all. I only wish we would, you know, could have been more help. We never did. After that, we went doodlebug shooting, and you could fire at these doodlebugs coming over. That was great fun.
Where was that from?
Oh, near Dover. Okay. Went a lot up there to try and stop them going up to London. Yeah. Occasionally you hit one or brought it down with an explosion, but not often. And then we went up to some Grimsby, I think it was, to be see what was wrong with the ship, and she was patched up temporarily with a broken back, and I left and became went to another ship.
Okay. Derek Plummer, end of reel 9. Derek Plummer, reel 10.
Yes.
So impulsive then is pensioned off.
Pensioned off, yes, broken up.
And you went to where?
I went to Liverpool to join a destroyer. Now I was a first lieutenant, so I'm, and it was Escapade.